The Father of Medicine, Hippocrates, the Beloved Physician. "What are you doing, my young friends?" The voice was mellow and pleasant, and the children, looking up, saw that the tones did not belie the speaker. He was a young man in his early 20s, with classic Greek features not as yet concealed by a beard. His finely shaped head was set off by close curls of dark hair. He carried his well-knit body firmly erect. He wore the long, loose tunic of the gentleman of his day. His legs were bare, his feet shod with light sandals. The scene was the small Grecian island of Kos, the time over 4 centuries before Christ. The 3 children addressed stopped for a moment in their strange occupation. One boy, the oldest of the group and about 14, had bound the legs of a goat and was now waving a long, sharp knife above its head. A second lad, some 2 years younger, was fanning a fire on a rude heap of stones, while a girl of about 8 was weeping bitterly but making no other move. "What are you doing?" the stranger asked again, and something in his friendly tones brought a frank reply. "We are sacrificing our pet goat, sir," the older boy said. At the words "pet goat," the girl sobbed afresh. "And why?" the man smiled as he entered the yard. "It is for her, our mother," the boy answered, pointing at the doorway. "She has been sick, oh, so long, and we are afraid she is going to die. We went to the temple, and the priest told us that if we sacrifice the thing we love best to Apollo, the great physician, our mother might get well." "I see," said the visitor thoughtfully. "But have you done everything else possible for your mother?" "Yes, sir," said the boy. "Yes, sir," said the younger boy eagerly. "We have kept the windows and doors tight closed to keep out the evil spirits, and we have kept her well covered up and a fire going." "I see," said the man again. "Do not kill your goat just yet. I also have worked in the temple of Apollo, and I know that he wants us to do everything possible for ourselves. Now I am a physician and the son of a physician. Let me see your mother." Partly because the man's bearing had won their confidence, and partly because they did not want to slay their pet, all 3 children said, "Oh, yes, sir." The girl dried her eyes and ran ahead of them to open the door. From what they had already said, the doctor was prepared for the sight which met his eyes. All too often he had seen it in the poorer homes. The room was tightly closed and suffocatingly hot. It had the odor of a sick room, despite some aromatic herbs which the children had left smoldering on the hearth. The woman herself was burning with a fever and tossed and moaned, one of her most frequent cries being for water. "Have you given her any water to drink?" the visitor asked. "Oh, no, sir, only soup." With 1 or 2 quick strides, the doctor approached the couch and intently regarded the sufferer. His cool hand took her hot one, but he did not feel her pulse. Any correct knowledge of the circulation of the blood was not to come until centuries later. However, Hippocrates, the physician who stood there, was far ahead of his time. His keen eyes and skilled touch told him many things. After a few minutes, he turned with decision to the children. "You must do as I tell you, and mayhap, if the gods will, your mother will get well. Now, first of all, less covering on this couch and all the windows open. They must be kept open at night as well." "No," he smiled at their doubting faces, "the night air will not harm you. It is as good as day air. We will give her a drink of cold water now, and small sips of it as often as she wants it. I shall give you some powders to dissolve in it, and we will make use of your fire outside for something better than to burn flesh of goats. Heat me a pail of water right speedily." The children ran to obey him without further question. In the meanwhile, he rolled up his sleeves, wet a coarse towel with cold water, and taking away the heavy covers which had shrouded the woman up to the chin, he laved her face and neck. As soon as the hot water was ready, he suddenly changed to a hot compress. The woman gasped, but after a moment relaxed. Changing from hot to cold and back again several times, Hippocrates busied himself for nearly an hour. The invalid had meanwhile fallen asleep, but her breathing was easier. Then the doctor turned to his 3 intent watchers. "Your father?" he asked. He will return tonight. He is working in the vineyards, answered the oldest. Good. Tell him that I, Hippocrates, son of Heraclides of the temple, will return at this same hour tomorrow. Meanwhile, you are to do just as I say in all things, and you are not to kill the goat. Oh, yes, sir, said the two boys. Oh, no, sir, said the little girl. The physician smiled. He knew that they had understood each other. Every day for the next week he called, and on the last day the woman was sitting up, and she was enjoying a bowl of goat's milk, much to the joy of her small daughter. Even the goat was contented, as well she might be, as she browsed in a field nearby. Such might well have been a visit paid by one of the greatest physicians of all time to a home of the poor. Let us follow him into the palace of the rich. It was a few years later, in the 88th Olympiad, as the Greeks reckon time. There was deep gloom in the house of Silenus. The young master, who had won renown in the Olympian Games, had been seized with a sudden and alarming illness. The past year had been remarkable for its climatic changes. A severe winter had been followed by a rainy spring, and a humid south wind prevailed in the summer. Silenus, usually the picture of robust manhood, had fallen a victim to a widespread disease. They called it a plague in those days. He was hot and cold by turns and could not rest in comfort. One moment he would be calling for coverings, the next he would toss them off. On the fourth day of his illness, an unaccustomed quiet had fallen on the household. The sound of flute and cithara had ceased. No longer was there animated chatter about the games or the latest hunt. Their bare feet of slaves made no noise as they ran quickly about their errands. Only the slight tinkle of a small fountain in the inner court and the chirping of birds taking a bath broke the silence. "Mistress, he has come," said a slave in a low voice to her lady, a comely young matron, who now dried her dark eyes and made haste to greet her distinguished guest, Hippocrates. For young as he was already famous. Let us look at him again as he walks gracefully along the marble corridor. His sandals had been taken off at the outer door and his feet washed with perfumed water by the slaves in the vestibule. He wore over his linen tunic a large flowing mantle of lavender shade, a light, fine woolen garment suited to the season and not unlike a Roman toga. It was fastened at the neck with a cameo bearing the face of Aesculapius and showing that the wearer was a member of the most famed of all ancient schools of medicine. But even without any badge of distinction, the face was one which at once commanded respect and confidence. The young woman sensed this as she seized a hem of his mantle and pressed it to her lips. "Oh, my good friend," she murmured. Hippocrates merely smiled and bowed, then waited for her to precede him into the sick chamber. There, as he paused beside the bed, his whole demeanor changed. His gaze grew so intent that he seemed actually to be reading the thoughts of the sick man who was his friend. After making a few inquiries and passing his hands over the sufferer's head and chest, he gave a startling prescription. "Take him out into the sunlight," he said. "Let him lie for an hour at a time in the sun. Only let his eyes be shaded. Then let one of the servants, who has been accustomed to rubbing his muscles both before and after the games, let him, I say, massage him gently until he falls asleep. And fall asleep he will, I think. Here are some herbs from which to make a lotion for him. I shall come again tomorrow." "Will he live?" asked the young wife anxiously when they were again in the vestibule. "I have seen many sicker men than he recover," he replied, smiling. Silenus did get well, although some of the old school practitioners shook their heads when they heard of the strange treatment and declared that it was only the young patrician's strong constitution that had pulled him through. Let us follow Hippocrates into one more sick chamber. It is the deathbed of Pericles that we witness. Pericles, the great statesman who had welded Grecian liberty together, and who had gathered about him such a glorious company of great men that ever since it has been called the Age of Pericles. Then it was that the lordly buildings on the Acropolis at Athens had been completed, the Parthenon under the hands of Phidias, the sculptor, outshining them all. Grouped around the bed were many famous men, generals, admirals, statesmen, poets, philosophers, artists, such men as Socrates, Alcibiades, Thucydides, Herodotus, and Xenophon, whose names and exploits were to endure for all time. Only one man was seated. He was Hippocrates, the physician. His fine face was now partly hidden by a curling beard, as was the fashion, and his eye and bearing had taken on an added dignity with the years. Amid that famous group, he was easily a peer. After a prolonged examination, the while the others maintained silence, Hippocrates rose and shook his head sadly. The great Pericles was beyond human aid. Outside the palace, the physician summoned a small group of the lawgivers. "This plague is too costly," he said. "It has taken the life of our great leader himself." "What can be done about it?" asked one. "It has ravaged both Sparta and Athens. Methinks the gods are angry." "It is not the gods," said Hippocrates impatiently. "It is only our own ignorance. We are giving food for the plague to work upon." "What mean you?" asked another. "Just this. See yonder group of hovels? In their dirt and filth the plague flourishes. I would build great fires and thus sweep the city clean." "What? Burn down whole rows of houses?" "Exactly. And on the flames I would sprinkle purifying herbs." The knot of men gazed at him incredulously. Then one after another they exclaimed, "Done." And burn out the plague spots they did, and eventually the dire pestilence was stopped. There is a legend that the people of Athens gave Hippocrates a crown of gold and held a public festival in his honor. We do not know this for a certainty, since, great though he was, few records remain of the actual facts of his life. We do know that he was born in the period of Athenian greatness. He was known as Hippocrates of Kos, from the small island in the Grecian cluster where he first saw the light of day about the year 460 BC. His birth corresponded almost exactly with the establishment of Greek independence. The Battle of Marathon had been fought 30 years before his day. He had doubtless listened to the heroic tales of Thermopylae, of Salamis, and of Plataea from the lips of veterans who had fought in those battles. After the defeat of the arrogant Xerxes, his mighty Persian army and navy had been driven off the Grecian coast. Then came the day of Greek splendor, the age of Pericles, of which we have already spoken. Hippocrates lived to be an old man, some say 90 or 100, and he was to see calamities fall upon Greece. But in the heyday of his life, he touched elbows with some of the most illustrious men who ever lived. It is said that his ancestor was the great Aesculapius, one of the first physicians. The father of Hippocrates and his father before him were doctors. They practiced in the temple of Aesculapius on the Isle of Kos, whither came hundreds seeking healing. It was really a large hospital, although very simple in its fittings compared with our modern institutions. Hippocrates was not content with the knowledge obtained here. He traveled widely, observing and studying. Whenever he heard of a new herb or a new treatment, he learned all that he could about it. He was one of the first to study anatomy and the current location of all the organs in the body. Above all, he was one of the first to fight superstition, the belief that gods or devils were to blame for one's illness. He pointed out that sickness too often arose from carelessness or ignorance, and by the same token could be cured by simple natural means. This is what he himself had to say about it. "As for this disease called divine, surely it too has its nature and causes whence it originates, just like other diseases, and is cured by the same means. It arises, like other diseases, from things which enter and quit the body, such as the cold, the sun, and the winds, things which are ever changing and never at rest. Such things are divine or not, as you will, but they are alike human." This remark is from a famous book which has come down to us through all the centuries. It is called The Aphorisms of Hippocrates, and it is still treasured for its wisdom. Although little is known definitely about his life, we do know that long before his death, he was widely famed and widely loved. We know that he left essays on medicine as well as these aphorisms or proverbs. He came to be called the father of medicine and built up a school of followers. Such was his fame after death that many writings were added by other hands to the works labeled as his own. A long array of volumes bearing his name was collected in the famous library at Alexandria 2 centuries later. He was also known and venerated in Arabia. Plato, his fellow countryman, who lived a few years later, speaks of him in high terms. One reason for his great fame and success was that he was the foe of both superstition and dirt. He insisted that his patients be clean and be kept in what we now call sanitary surroundings. He wrote papers on such everyday things as airs, waters, and places, epidemics, acute diseases, fractures, injuries of the head, and many another problem every doctor has had to face. So wise and so human was he that a doctor of today has said of him, "Just as it is impossible to speak of Mohammedanism without reference to Muhammad, so it is impossible to discuss medicine without making some allusion to Hippocrates. He was unquestionably a great doctor, and there is no doubt that he did more with a wet handkerchief at numberless sick beds than many a scientist today with all his apparatus." Hippocrates left much wise counsel to his students in his school at Kos, where he returned in his old age. Let us picture him there, a striking figure despite his years. His full beard is sprinkled with silver, and the top of his head is bald. But his eyes still flash with that inner light which has helped so many patients in all the years past to get well. The day is sunny, and the sharp shafts of light strike down through the grove of oaks on the hillside where sit his students. He himself stands below them. In the foreground is a park with winding walks and playing fountains, while back of this is the stately temple of Aesculapius, with its Ionic columns and ornamental marble friezes. The beauty of those ancient Greek buildings still challenges the admiration of the world. At the door of the temple are marble fonts, from which gush jets of lustral water for the purification of the sick ere they enter the portals. The young men are much in earnest. They have helped in the temple with many kinds of sickness. They have performed simple operations. They have read books on philosophy, a science which at the time was closely linked with medicine. They have worked in the gymnasia, or training schools for athletes, for the Greeks always took great pride in bodily prowess. They were the people who founded the Olympian Games. Now the students are listening intently to this kindly old man, as if to a prophet, as indeed he was. He had gone through many lands healing and teaching, like that other great teacher of Galilee who was to come after him. What is this he is saying today? It is not about illness and is not couched in learned medical terms. Young men, you are to go out into the world with a great mission, the mission of health, but you cannot succeed in it unless you yourself have good health. You must be sympathetic but firm in your treatment of patients. You must never tell a patient, however ill, that he is going to die. You must preach healing. You must strive to allay the doubts and fears of both the patient and his friends, for fear is a terrible enemy, and you must not give way to doubt or fear yourself. If in doubt about a case, do not hesitate to call in some skilled physician for advice. Dress yourselves cleanly, correctly, and soberly. Be temperate in eating and drinking. Treat every patient as a personal friend. Do not despise pay for your services, but do not be overeager or greedy. Do not abuse your trust or any patient's confidence. Be honest. And remember this, life is short, art is long, the occasion fleeting, experience not always to be trusted, and judgment is difficult. As the sage paused for breath, his auditors gave voice to a low murmur of appreciation. They did not know that, centuries later, in our own day, a poet was to voice this age-old proverb of Hippocrates, "Art is long and time is fleeting." Longfellow, our poet, might well have had this early physician in mind when he wrote, "Lives of great men all remind us we may make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time." Hippocrates stilled the eager voices of his pupils by raising his hand. "Young men," he said, "before you go out into the world, I want you to take an oath with me, an oath of fidelity. Will you do so?" "We will, we will," they assented, even before he had told them the words of this obligation. May I pause one moment more to say that the oath of Hippocrates has remained the most quoted of all the sayings of the father of medicine. It has come down through the centuries to countless thousands of medical students as an incentive to do right. Today, in slightly modified form, the obligation is still administered to candidates for the degree of medicine in our great colleges. But Hippocrates is speaking. "Young men, raise your right hands and repeat after me. I do solemnly swear by all that which I hold most sacred, that I will be loyal to the profession of medicine and just and generous to its members, that I will lead my life and practice my art in uprightness and honor, that into whatsoever house I enter, it shall be for the good of the sick to the utmost of my power, I holding myself aloof from wrong, from corruption, from the tempting of others to vice, that I will exercise my art solely for the cure of my patients, and I will give no drug, perform no operation for a criminal purpose, even if solicited, far less suggested, that whatsoever I shall see or hear of the lives of men, which is not fitting to be spoken, I will keep inviolably secret. These things I do promise, and in proportion as I am faithful to this my oath, may happiness and good repute be ever mine, and let it be the opposite if I shall be forsworn." Clause by clause and sentence by sentence, the Greek youths with uplifted hands repeated the binding obligation, and as they spoke, the level rays of the western sun shone full upon the head of their teacher, making him seem like one not of this earth. "I am satisfied," he said simply when they had closed. "Be true to your oath. Tomorrow I go on a journey from which I may not return. I have had a dream urging me to go into Thessaly." What his vision was, or what his work there, we know not. But in Thessaly, at an advanced age, he was gathered to his fathers. His tomb was built on the road leading to Larissa, and for years it was the object of pilgrimages. Some of the many who came to his grave were still in search of healing. There is a legend that a hive of bees made their home upon the tomb until it was completely covered, and the honey was said to have been a sovereign remedy for some of the ills of infants. So, even in death, the beloved physician ministered to them.